there's a lot to be said for somebody being able to, you know, sort their own problems out for themselves. I mean, that's a big part of my philosophy is I think people have the answers to the problems, but maybe they just need help finding them.
Welcome back to Black Snake Bites. I'm your host, Tech Sergeant Kathleen LaCourte. Today I have a special guest in the studio with us. His name is Ben Reeser, and he's the new Director of Psychological Health for the 122nd Fighter Wing, the new DPH. Thanks for being here, Ben.
Oh, I'm really glad to be. I'm glad to be, you know, here talking to you, and also glad to be, you know, in the spot, in the seat, as it were.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I think it's going to be a great fit for the 122nd Fighter Wing and really excited about it. Thanks for just talking to all of us today.
Totally.
I think it's great for the Black Snakes to get to know you. And if there's anyone out there that is looking for someone to just sit down and talk with, Ben's available. And this is kind of a way for us all to get to know him just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
You have a military background. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I joined the Army, active duty Army, right out of high school in the delayed entry program. I graduated, and then I don't even think I walked, but I went right to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I was a 13 Foxtrot, 13 Fox fire support specialist, Ford Observer, all those things kind of rolled into one. So did basic and AIT in 2010 is when I enlisted, basic and AIT at Fort Sill. And then my first duty station, went through basic and AIT. I had an airborne ranger contract, with, you know, going through the ranger regiment selection process. So I went to airborne school, graduated there. My kind of famous quip out here is my experience with airplanes has been falling out of them. You guys can stay in them. Spent a lot of my first year in TRADOC, training and doctrine command with Army. I didn't make it to Ranger School, or excuse me, Ranger the Ranger Regiment. I withdrew after a couple weeks in the selection, was just. It's a combination of a lot of things. I was really fatigued from being in a training environment. I didn't feel like I was like physically up to snuff. Like if you look at me, I'm kind of a big guy, and not to say big guys can't run, but a lot of what they're looking for was running. And I was something, maybe it was a mental thing in my head, but I just didn't have it in my mind that I was a runner that way. So I made the decision to withdraw. And you know, they were actually really cool about it. Got orders cut to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, 1st Squadron of the 73rd Cavalry Regiment. It was my first duty station. Now stood down. They've cased the colors. So we'll see if they open them up again in upcoming conflicts. So I was a Ford Observer. So if people aren't familiar with Ford Observer, think of like a JTAC, but several orders of magnitude, like lower. Like we observed fire for artillery, mortars, rotary wing aircraft, fixed wing aircraft in a real limited way. Basically like, here I am, can you blow that thing up over there? Finally, pilot, you've got ultimate or final weapons release authority. But we would do a lot of communications work. I was pretty proficient with using the radio. So me and actually it was a battle buddy of mine. We were together for basic, AIT, airborne school, ranger selection, and then we got stationed in the same unit, 173 Cav. Get to Fort Bragg. It's an interesting place. If you've ever been out to Fort Bragg, as we were talking about earlier, it does have that work hard, play hard kind of experience out there. And so, you know, living in the barracks, it's all new adjustments. So military service was a big step for me developmentally, as far as, you know, developing, being a young man, getting independent. Started drinking pretty heavily, but that was pretty normal. So things didn't really stand out or get into a problem. So we deployed and finished out Operation New Dawn, which was the final phase of combat operations in Iraq.
Okay.
We were there from beginning of 2011 to the end of 2011, about 10 months long, I think it was deployment. Started out in Al Asad Air Base is where we started out, doing a lot of training for the Iraqi military. We just kind of supervised. They had some trainers, but we also were running people through the HIDE system. Did about 3 months there, for our first part of our deployment, and then we transitioned to Baghdad. We convoyed down to Baghdad and took up residence in Liberty Base Complex. We were in Camp Liberty on that part of the living area. Ran combat operations out of there, doing a lot of presence patrols, a lot of convoy security, route clearance, weapons cache searches, a lot of maneuver on the ground. We were running missions probably 4 days a week at that point. So the op tempo was pretty high then. We did some QRF stuff. Got mortared, got rocketed. They were doing IRAMs a lot at that point in time. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that I did, we were so hard for 360 degree security on the vehicles, because the gunners had blind spots. So we would, at certain points in time, do what was called an air guard, which was extremely dangerous now that you look back on it. I was the air guard in my truck. So we would stand on our seats in the back of the Max Pros. If you guys mm-hmm. ever seen the Max Pros, the seats aren't very big. So perch on top of the seat and move the big escape hatch out of the way and pop out with the M4 and, you know, basically our torsos out above the ceiling of the up-armored vehicle.
Right.
You know, pull security. That was a interesting thing to do going, 30 miles down the road, 30 miles an hour down the road. So we finished up combat operations there. 2nd Brigade Combat Team was the last major military unit to come out of Baghdad. We closed down Liberty Base Complex, and we lived for about a month in the green zone in one of the old palaces. Redeployed home. I had turned 21 in the back of the truck in Iraq. My birthday was the day that we closed Liberty Base Complex down, our presence down there, and went over to the green zone. And that was nice because we started getting hot chow again. Before that, it was just MREs.
MREs every single day.
Oh, yeah. It's bad when you're like, I actually kind of prefer the MREs.
That is bad.
Yeah. So when we finally did get back, we got home for Christmas, which was really nice. At that point, I was 21. So again, even before I was 21, drinking was still kind of a big thing. It just got more and more. Did weigh a lot on the decisions that I made when I was choosing to socialize. It was a lot of the times it had to do with drinking. And sometimes, good and bad. I'll tell you a story about that here in a moment. But it wasn't something I was really paying attention to. And I should have been. I didn't have any problems. I wasn't, driving drunk, anything like that. It was just kind of just drinking a lot. I had chosen not to go to our squadron ball. Squadrons in the Army are a little bit different than in the Air Force. The company level of organization in the Army, in the cavalry, is called a troop. And the battalion level, kind of the wing level mm-hmm. of organization, is called a squadron. And so basically it was our wing sort of battalion level ball that was going on. I decided not to go because I wanted to stay home and drink instead, essentially. Well, lucky that I did to a degree, because I was the most sober one available when some of my buddies got back. I got a call from my first line supervisor saying, hey, man, are you staff sergeant type? E6 type. He says, hey, man, are you up? You available? I was like, yeah, what's going on, sergeant? I'm just hanging out in the room. No big deal. Well, we're going to bring so-and-so back. He's pretty drunk, and we need somebody to keep an eye on him. I guess. Yeah. What he didn't tell me was that this guy had gotten very intoxicated and started making some pretty concerning statements at the ball. Then started saying things about how he's going to end his life when he got back to the barracks.
Oh, no.
For background, this guy, he was new to our unit. He had just got to the unit before he deployed, so he was really rapid deployment. Newly married to high school sweetheart. When he got back, to nothing in his house, nothing in his bank account, no wife. And he didn't know any of that. So he walked into all of that.
Walked into
his apartment, and it was empty. We didn't know that was going on so much at all.
He didn't really talk about it.
No, he didn't. He didn't share it at all. And so he's kind of pouring all this stuff out. He had a plan for suicide and everything. He was my roommate at the time. And I was just like, wow, I had no idea. And so myself and another of my battle buddies, we just stayed up with him all night long and just watched him and made sure he was okay. And I asked my first line the next day, what's going on with him? Maybe he should get some help, maybe? And just kind of got met with deafening silence. My dad was an Army social worker. And I started talking to him, hey, Dad, what do you think I should do here? And he's like, well, you could go to social work in the Army. I started really thinking about that and finally did pull the trigger on the application, got accepted, got out to go to school and got an ROTC and was doing the Green to Gold program. Anyways, while the whole process was going on, still drinking heavily, wasn't having many effects. I was a young guy. It was okay. And really got myself into some trouble with some drinking-related behavior. Nothing, you know, crazy. You know, just made some bad choices. Nobody got hurt. I didn't get hurt. Didn't cause any damage to anybody. Just made some poor choices that really affected my career. And ended up with me getting out. That was a very difficult thing for me to kind of square about how things are going to change. And I was not ready for that change. I wouldn't say I was asleep at the wheel, but I wasn't paying attention to what the impact things were going in life for me. I thought it was pretty normal. You know, this whole idea, I'm in college, I'm a military guy, I'm a veteran. It's okay. And that was a time in my life where I really started to go through a lot of introspection, change, and acceptance, really, of this is not the way that I thought life would go. And that, you know what? That's kind of okay. I'm just going to kind of go with it. I talk a lot about acceptance and the idea that kind of Frankl pushes with acceptance being somewhat akin to what is life or the universe asking of me right now, and how can I best meet that goal? How can I show up best for that at this point in time? And the book Man's Search for Meaning really kind of guided me through a lot of that transition time. At that time, I was working, I was finishing my undergraduate, so I was in human services, so it's kind of like social work related. And I was working second shift at the rescue mission here in Fort Wayne. So I'd work about, was it 3 to 11 or 4 to 12, something like that. And having a lot of real interesting experiences throughout the night, kind of seeing on the back end how, you know, significant substance abuse impacted people, having to make hard decisions with people about, hey, you violated the rules so many times, you know, this and this, we're not going to be able to let you stay past the weekend or whatever. And that was pretty difficult work, just with the number of hours they needed people to work, and also working with the population. So I finished that and finally moved into the legal system. I finished undergraduate and got a job with the Allen Superior Court in the drug court, working for Judge Fran Gall. She was a really, really great person to work for, giving people a chance in the restorative court process. That was where I started to learn a lot about what problem-solving courts are. And problem-solving courts are kind of the best solution that we have in the criminal justice world to address some of the systemic problems that come from mental health, substance abuse, adverse childhood experiences early on in life, the things that on the front end affect people and how not just they affect those people on the front end, but move to affect kind of society in a larger end. So getting people engaged in services, maybe if they don't want to be, but to address some of those issues. That was a lot of what I did as a case manager and a field officer for the drug court and the veterans court as well. I was the veterans court case manager and one of the low risk case managers for the rest of the drug court. So yeah, I did that for about 3 years before I got into graduate school. Started grad school part-time, 3-year program, and got an internship with the VA. It was where I did most of my training when I was in grad school. Started in primary care mental health integration, which is kind of same day mental health care access. And then I moved into the substance abuse clinic and did my other internship with the substance abuse folks. And that was where it was kind of a long way to say that was a lot of the stuff that I was working on in my personal life. And I should mention as well, when I did exit the military, I made the decision to stop drinking. And so I haven't had a drink since October the 18th, 2014. That was the last time I had something to drink. And life is better for me that way. So all these experiences that I had were kind of preparing me, I think, to work in the SUD world. My personal experiences working with people out on the street who are trying to maybe get off of that cycle of substance abuse, or maybe aren't ready to do that yet, but still giving them a little bit of support and services. It's so hard to balance that between enabling and actually helping somebody.
Yeah.
That's a whole conversation in and of itself. And I don't have the answers for that. Working in the kind of the programmatic development, administrative world of case management with the legal system, I really prepared me pretty well, I think, to work in the substance abuse world. So I worked in the substance abuse clinic I started thinking about wanting to work in the substance abuse clinic during my internship there. Like, this is actually something I could really do. I'd be stoked to get into there. Well, I did graduate, and I didn't end up getting into the substance abuse clinic until about 3 years into my work at the VA. I started at VA in 2020. Yeah, 2020. And I was on the acute psych unit down in Marion. And so we're responsible for helping out folks that were having imminent suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, acute psychosis, or kind of destabilizations to long-term serious persistent mental illness. I did a lot of suicide risk evaluations. I was on the Code Pink team at that time. So pretty comfortable with asking some of those hard questions. One thing I want to say is that if you do ever have concerns about somebody, if they're wanting to end their life, you asking them if they've, hey, have you thought about killing yourself, is not going to put the idea in their head. Over and over again, research shows us that that's not the case. And if it's at the level that you're even wondering, if somebody's considering that, it's probably the case that they've considered it. Anyways, I know that that's an uncomfortable thing to kind of face sometimes, but just maybe some encouragement that you asking that way is not going to put that in someone's
head. It is super uncomfortable. I know I've struggled with that too, like just wondering about someone, like, how do I put this? How do I say this? What do I do?
And then what do I do with their answer?
Right.
You don't have to do anything. Just be there, and then you can call me. Yeah. Call me. Hey, I'm worried about so-and-so. Why are you worried about so-and-so? Well, they said this and this. Oh, do you think they'd be cool if I gave them a call? Well, I don't know. Let me ask him. Or, you know, maybe, you know, offer my services, or maybe, you know, if we're obviously really concerned, we'll reach out and figure it out. But I guess what I'm saying is you don't have to do anything with that. You don't have to have the answers. What maybe the answer would be is escorting to care, as right. You know, the ACE card says. Because that is I definitely see that as an anxiety. Okay, so what do I do with this information now? Wow, that sounds like you're really struggling. I'm glad that you, thanks for telling me. Let's go find out, you know, let's go talk to that bald guy.
I like that. Yes. That takes a lot of pressure off. Yeah.
No pressure. It's my job to help with that stuff. Seriously. So I'm really comfortable with that stuff. I did a lot of brief interventions with people on the acute unit while they're just kind of stabilizing out. So I got pretty used to that, the dynamic nature of work. Was driving to Marion every day, and I lived in Fort Wayne. So I was hoping to, you know, not do that forever. After about 2 years of that, I got into case management in the community-based case management for serious and persistent mental illness, the mental health case management team in Fort Wayne at the VA. And that was an interesting job. Did that for, I think, about six or 8 months. It wasn't for me. It was a lot of long-term management of mental illness. And it's not necessarily something that I really wanted to do, but it was interesting to and I think useful to build relationships with people who did struggle with serious mental illness, because otherwise they'd be totally cut off. Had some really good experiences at VA. As a nature of all of my VA experience, I have a pretty good understanding of the way it works. So if you have questions about VA, come ask me, and I can get you pointed in the right direction. Okay. I'll get the people that have phone numbers, and you know, you'll start getting them. So, did that for about not real long time, about 6 months. And then finally a position in the substance abuse clinic, came open. And so I started with the substance abuse clinic, and at that time, they were really going through a big transition. We essentially redesigned the whole program from the bottom up. We offered two sections of intensive outpatient programming, which is, just a more intense, outpatient, program. Go for 9 hours a week of therapy, and also have individual therapy, you know, group and individual therapy. We revamped that. I rebuilt a lot of the curriculum, really did a lot of the program design for curriculum that we're offering, and you know, how we're offering it. I did a lot of planning for kind of unity and messaging, did training for new staff that would come on, new social workers, as well as new peers. I supervised three students while I was there. Really started to move into, I guess, in the social work world, more of like the proficient kind of I don't want to say mentor necessarily, but kind of helping the next generation to have some of the skills and experiences that I had that were impactful. So did that for about 3 years, and honestly, just the op tempo of in and out at work was just taking a toll on me. I had 36 clinical hours a week, basically, that had to be booked, and they usually were booked. But again, as I was talking about earlier with balance, when I was honest with myself, what is this? I don't want to keep saying op tempo, but what is this thing that I'm doing? If I'm investing myself, if I'm really giving it my best, where is it taking from? And it was starting to take from some of my time with my family. My wife and I have two little girls, 1 and 4 years old. So it was 2 nights a week. I'd have to stay home till 7. I would miss bedtime. Then I only had 3 nights a week, you know, with them. And then it was kind of a lot that way. And I was kind of feeling fatigued from doing some of the work. And my wife was fatigued from me doing the work because I was, you know, not there all the time. And so one of my student I was supervising, Mitch Shelton, if you guys, you know, some guys might know Mitch. He said, hey, we have this position at the base, you know, I retired from. It's come open. Maybe you might want to think about applying. So I took a look at the position. I think this is kind of up my alley. I have good understanding of the way the military works. I don't know the Air Force so much. But I've got all these kind of conglomeration of skills and experiences that would kind of make me a good fit for this kind of thing. So that basically is how I got here. Applied, and Chief Hoop thought I was appropriate, and you know, here I am. Sorry, it's a long way to answer your question.
No, that's a great story, and I'm really glad you're here. I think it's a great fit for the 122nd Fighter Wing, for sure. I had a question, too. So you were talking about your deployment,
mm-hmm.
and I know when I was deployed, which it wasn't as long or as difficult or as dangerous as yours by any stretch of the imagination, but, and I know that I've talked to other people that have deployed, and when they come back, and I experienced this myself, is a little bit of, it's like it changes you somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed with myself that I struggled with anger sometimes, just like frustration and anger that would come up. And I'm like, where is this coming from? It does change you. It's so I don't know if you have any perspective or understanding of like what is it that happens to you sometimes when you deploy and you come back and you're trying to reintegrate into the civilian world or just regular life, and you struggle with these issues that come up, and like your response to them mm-hmm. is different. And, you know, it also does make you start from those experiences, start making you like look around to like, okay, what can make me feel better?
Yeah. Military service, particularly deployments, they do change. I think they change people. You know, I suppose it's maybe like a matter of philosophy, but I do think that is an impactful experience that is totally alien to normal life. You know, United States is a pretty safe place. We enjoy a lot of comfort and safety and security. When you go to a deployed environment like Iraq, Afghanistan, even, you know, where the Air Force might deploy to, like Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, you're going to do a particular job to visit violence, you know, foundationally mm-hmm. on the enemies of the United States.
Right.
That is inherently dangerous. It comes with risks. It is not prudent to not consider those risks. And in a deployed environment, when you do things like maybe don't have a depressed, have a wide range of emotional expression, you know, there's calm and then there's hostility, that might be helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be useful to keep your head on a swivel. It's helpful if your sleep isn't all, if you're, you know, a light sleeper because you get up. That's an abnormal environment. And those things are, it's normal to, I think, respond in those ways. It's not normal when you come back to a relatively safe environment I don't want to say it's not normal. Maybe it's not always helpful when those systems persist in a relatively normal environment. That's where I think a lot of, maybe you're putting your finger on, a lot of dysfunction can come out. That the habits or maybe some of the behaviors that I engaged in when I was deployed,
yeah.
those were useful. And they were significantly useful. Because they accomplished the goal for safety and the immediacy that I needed. I needed to pay attention to my surroundings. It kept me safe. It's a lesson it's been well ingrained. behaviors can be tied, habits can be tied to highly emotional experiences, being in danger, being in a car accident, maybe being robbed. You're going to do things as a result of that because it did something in that moment, and there's a belief that's formed. Like, well, now I have to do this thing.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. If we're not aware of that stuff, if we don't maybe have a good sounding board for someone to be like, to share that, hey, this is different, and it can be hard to hear that. Hey, you're different. No, I'm not. I'm the same as ever. But if we don't have some kind of awareness of that, as we kind of mentioned earlier, it's going to be really, really easy for habits to be solidified and form that maybe aren't always the most helpful. But kind of to put a more precise answer to your question, it's not always bad to be changed either. Going to a different country, meeting a different culture, having a different experience, that is who you are now.
It is enriching.
It is.
Yeah.
And maybe the things that you, it's not immediately enriching. Maybe you go through a struggle and you come out on the other side. That's okay too. That's good too. Where I think maybe run into a lot of trouble is I'm having maybe these symptoms of, we'll say PTSD. I have these PTSD symptoms. I don't know what to do with them, so I'm going to do nothing with them. I'm just going to shove it down, just jam it at the bottom of my rucksack and not worry about it.
Yeah.
Wishing something is going to be the way it is not going to make the thing change. So again, kind of call back to having an awareness of where we're at, what's going on. It's good to have that baseline even before you deploy or do anything, I think.
Yeah. How would you explain the difference between military life and civilian life? Like, what is it that military members go through or potentially go through with deployments that civilians will never understand?
You could always die at any point in time. Somebody probably wants to kill you, like personally. That was something that really sticks in my head from my deployment. Like, not everybody I interacted with wanted to kill me, but there was people that wanted to kill me personally. Mm-hmm. Like they'd be all right with it. They'd be glad if I died. You don't maybe get that when you go to the deli. That's not an occupational hazard usually.
No.
Or, if you go to a factory, work at a factory or work in a florist shop, or you're an accountant. Usually, if you're on the up and up, not if you're an organized crime or something, people don't want to kill you. And I don't mean to like over dramatize or belittle that fact, but that's a huge difference that there is as a member of the military, there's that ongoing threat of death. And how are we going to counter that? So kind of coping with that specter, being upfront with it is prophylactic, is protective, as opposed to, some experiences you get into, I didn't sign up for this. So I think that would probably be one of the things I think is very, very different. On the other hand is there's an interesting kind of contradiction where there's a kind of a demand from command to always be balancing military life and private life, because you're not going to be any good in the military if your private life's all jacked up.
Right.
If wife's running off, or if the kids are disconnected, it's going to impact you ultimately somewhere down the line in your military life. But it's hard to do that balancing, to be fully in here and fully in there. How do you do it? I think most people say, well, you don't. You pick one, which sucks too. And I think that's another thing that maybe the civilian world doesn't quite get, because this is a vocation. It's not just a job, profession of arms. For some people, it's a job. But profession of arms asks a lot from you. And if there's not real intentional balance there, then it can really, really, as you guys know, I'm no expert, just on my own, can get out of hand real quick.
Yeah, and it's not like a job where you can just decide not to show up one day.
No, there's rules about that.
It's like you're kind of stuck once you're in. You have to continue performing.
And as much as we talk about like post-traumatic stress and how you can be debilitated by periods of trial, I also want to emphasize you can be enriched by periods of growth after challenges. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it sucks, the job you're doing right now, but it's not going to suck forever. This isn't forever. You can do things differently. There's almost everybody I've talked to, in a clinical sense as well as just kind of on base, everybody's like, oh yeah, this is like my fourth AFSC. Like people retrain a lot and move around and jump around, and it's kind of boggles my mind with all the technical training you guys do. But there is opportunity for other things, particularly in a community small and supportive as the 122nd. I've seen a lot of leaders emphasizing, we want you to do well. And that's really cool to see.
And I really appreciate, too, sharing about your substance abuse issues mm-hmm. and your time in the military, because when I was a kid, my mom's a really wise person, and she always told us, hey, if you're going through a hard time, something difficult, just think about someday you might be able to help someone else who's going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was a kid, I was like, yeah, mom, okay, that doesn't really help me right now. But she was right. And someday, there are other people that will probably be going through so many of the same things that I went through.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe slightly different, but, similar situations. And it really does offer you the opportunity to come alongside someone else and be there for them.
And I think really demonstrate that, hey, other person, you are not alone.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't like, as a helper, I would never tell somebody I know what they're going through. I understand what you're going through. Nobody does. And when people say, I know what you're going through, they don't. Everybody's not to be too touchy-feely and snowflake about it, but everybody's experience is their own.
Mm-hmm.
You might have like a bit of an understanding or able to, empathically place yourself in that person's shoes. Have had similar experiences for sure. But what I think that messaging does to people who are struggling is really emphasizes that you're not alone, that what your experience is a human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not cut off from help and support. Other people have had those similar experiences too. Good things have happened, bad things have happened, but here they are still. And that's part of what I've emphasized in the past with my work with substance abuse. Hey man, I obviously don't know what you're going through. You got a lot of hard stuff happening. This is where I came from this. I've had similar experiences. I'm not going to sit here and judge you and tell you how bad you are and wiggle my finger and say, naughty, naughty, no, no. Wow. Yeah. You really made some choices based on the information that you had at the time, the resources. Like, yeah, maybe those aren't the best choices. You accept that, understand that. What's going to be different in the future? And that was really helpful when I was working in the substance abuse clinic, and hopefully, I hope it will be now, just working, as far as with military experience, to kind of break down some of that barrier earlier on. Like, I'm not going to tell you that I know everything you're going through. I'm not an expert on you. You're an expert on you. I'm glad to be an assistant and not somebody who's going to sit here and judge you and tell you how bad you are.
Kind of like a chicken and the egg question is, does the military attract certain types of people that tend to maybe have some extra trauma in their background that causes them to be attracted to more stressful, more dangerous jobs that require a little bit more of that work hard, play hard mentality to kind of get through it all?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the military that causes that kind of mentality?
I would kind of agree with you that it is a chicken or the egg kind of question, but we can tag it from both ways.
Mm-hmm.
People who have had earlier experiences in life, adverse childhood experiences that are particularly stressful, they're used to that kind of lifestyle. So having a high op tempo, particularly people who are high performers coming from a high stress environment, they would be. I would say absolutely they'd be attracted to that kind of hard charging lifestyle. Now, on the other hand, there's also a culture in the military. I mean, it's kind of explicit even when you get into initial entry training in the military, or you get to your first duty station. The first time I stepped off for chow, when I was in intake at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, we started singing cadence, shoot him in the head, kill him.
Right.
So there's an indoctrination to a degree as well early on about, you know, this hard charging lifestyle is what the military is about. Right. So people maybe who don't have that background might be indoctrinated into that as well. And again, it's the profession of arms. This is military service. It's inherently dangerous. It makes sense that people would tend that kind towards that kind of, again, high performance mentality. To that end, you know, kind of what maybe a part of DPH perspective that I bring is to kind of help to maybe balance that a little bit. Yeah. Bring some balance and you know, fresh set of eyes on how you know, dealing with things outside of a work environment.
When you talk about balance, what do you see that military members could do to keep themselves on the straight and narrow and on the rails, per se, as like staying proficient in their duties, progressing in their career, and keeping their family life and personal life in a healthy way?
So I was listening to a podcast yesterday, I think, and it was with a former Navy SEAL who was talking about someone that came from DevGru, from the development group, to their unit. And this guy was just outperforming everybody. And he was, this guy was a high performer himself. And he went to kind of observe this new guy that came from DevGru. And over time, what he found out was this guy's kind of philosophy was, you need to devote everything to the military. Everything else takes a back seat. And his message was, that's kind of what it takes to be the best in this. And I suppose it's kind of a long way to start answering your question is, the best way to assess balance is, what do you want from life? Being intentional and kind of honest. What do I want to have happen? If I'm going to be the absolute best or drive the most progress in my job, acknowledging there's going to be costs and being upfront with yourself on the front end about, you know, what do I want and what's the cost of what do I want is pretty protective, because when things start to go wrong or maybe stress increases, there's at least maybe an understanding with self like, yeah, okay, well, I also expected this. However, that doesn't mean that that's necessarily what we want and what's good for us match up. So on the back end, then there is also, I think, a need for honesty with self. Okay, self, so now I've poured in a lot of this time, energy, resources, and effort into maybe one aspect of life. We'll say military life. Starting to cause me some issues at home. Maybe it's starting to cause issues, you know, personally, psychologically. If I'm honest with myself, is this sustainable? And so maybe what I'd say with balance is it's kind of a mindset of an understanding, the internal balances. Here's what I'm expending, risking, and on the other hand, here's what the real cost is. If I'm really honest with myself, National Guard, I think, has a pretty good way of balancing that citizen soldier kind of mentality, but obviously, you guys have been doing a whole lot, particularly in the last 3 years, where that request for balance has been kind of suspended to a degree because of the high op tempo, what the mission demands. Hopefully, there will be a time soon where there can be kind of a reset, rebalance, and forward with growth. Is that?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd like to be part of, kind of helping with that.
Exactly.
As I can.
Yeah. What I really appreciate about the 122nd Fighter Wing is they really prioritize support for the airmen. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, it's always going to be inherently a stressful, dangerous job, but that doesn't mean that we can't have the best support for the airmen that we can possibly have within our ability.
And taking advantage of support.
Right.
When people are going through stressful times, maybe it's the last thing in the world you want to do is reach out for somebody else. But again, kind of being honest with self, understanding, maybe doing an assessment of kind of where am I at? How do I know I'm at this place? Doing some work on the front end is going to eliminate work on the back end. So if I can implement some kind of stress management or something like that on the front end, do things that kind of keep me well, I'm not going to be as unwell later on. Kind of pay dividends.
And I'm sure you understand this feeling, having been in the military yourself, but the reticence to kind of, quote, mess up your career if you admit that you have needs or struggles, how would you address that?
So I can kind of speak to the DPH role. My aim isn't to disqualify anybody from service put something in writing or paperwork that's going to get you kicked out or anything like that. The aim is to really be a support. And problems are going to manifest. Problems just don't get better by themselves. You know, if you have a flat tire, it's not just going to go away.
Right.
The things that we do, the behaviors that we engage in, the thoughts that we think are all kind of part of habits. And habits and behavior, they do something for us. They meet a particular need. Over time, if we're not meeting the needs that we have in real, like, fulfilled ways, so maybe when I get home from, you know, from work, and it's helpful for me to sit down and eat a bag of potato chips in front of the TV. If I do that every night, once in a while, it's probably not going to, you know, really, really hurt me. But if I do it over and over again, there's going to be some fallout downstream. It's the same with any behavior. And so if we can catch kind of thought patterns early on, can really ameliorate and take care of mitigate problems downstream. So maybe there will be a little bit of discomfort. Maybe it's not pleasant to talk about, you know, things with, you know, the bald DPH guy. But it will be more uncomfortable later, potentially. And coming and talk to me doesn't mean you have to. You can stay for as long, as little as you like, up to 6 sessions with, like, case management for me. But if you want to get referred to other for treatment or for mental health care, or peer support, or just want some suggestions about support groups or resources in the area, you know, really all things are on the table. It doesn't have to just be, you know, I'm feeling, you know, mentally unstable.
Part of some of the stress of being in the military is relationships. And when you have maybe a spouse, even children, they don't understand sometimes, if they're not in the military, what you're going through. How does that work out? How does that shake out?
This is probably a part of the other, it's not only exclusive to the military, but I think it's to a higher degree to the civilian population. There's a push, or that was a push at least, or a culture of this zero defect kind of culture in the past, when I was in the Army for sure. If you got any problems with you, you get a DUI, you go to mental health, you do anything off beat, you're out. Mm-hmm. You're not useful to the military anymore. You're a scumbag. You're not going to be promoted. You're going to be stagnated. Your dreams are crushed, essentially.
Yeah.
Obviously, if, you know, some significant things happen, like you kill a guy, like maybe that's not, you know, going to be the best outcome for right. military service. But largely speaking, there isn't a zero defect in the military. A lot of people have a lot of warts, but there is still almost a little bit of a culture of, you know, well, I can't express this kind of weakness. And so I think that segues into the family a little bit of – usually it's men in the military, but, you know, spouses, women, females as well. I have the status as military member. So that means, what does that mean about me? It means I have to be unfailing, rock hard,
strong,
never show weakness, never demonstrate any kind of negative emotion, everything, take everything in stride, mm-hmm. so easy. And I think there's probably pressure at home and at work to play that up. The military wants a lot from you. And I don't know. I mean, I know that spouses understand that. So I don't mean to belittle that at all. But it's a little bit different when there's a demand for national security being placed on your shoulders. You feel like it's personally placed on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And it's between that and picking up the groceries on time.
Right.
So some things slip, and I'm not saying that's a great thing either. Relationships are so important. This is why I was kind of banging on in the pre-deployment trainings about, if you are deploying, you must have a plan for regular, consistent communication with your family, particularly with your children, in some kind of way, writing letters, emails, instant messaging, FaceTime, all that kind of stuff, because maintenance of those relationships is essential. sometimes I think families have this belief, maybe wrongly, rightly, don't know, that, as I kind of mentioned earlier, there's this choice. And the choice isn't, you know, between family and military. I don't think the choice is always, like, cognizant. You're not always aware of that choice that you're making because, you know, things slip just a little bit there, a little bit there, a little bit extra time here. Then when members, you know, service members, airmen are start to be aware of the fallout from that, they're now more aware than they were, that can be pretty uncomfortable too. Like, no, I am present as a partner, as a spouse. Like, no, you're not. Like, you're always at the base, or you're, you know, long hours, or whatever.
Yeah, I kind of understand the feeling. It's like you feel like your family will always be there. It's just a feeling in the back of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the military is performance based.
Yep.
So which one gets, you know, the immediate attention?
And I think maybe something just to be encouraging to families is, I don't think any military member actively, not any, I'm sure some, but say you guys have to take a back seat.
Yeah.
Usually it's just considered, you know, part of service too, which is good. I'm not saying that, you know, the military family's backbone. But I don't think that people are actively making a choice to dismiss their family. It's incremental, I think. It
yes.
happens over time.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was something maybe I would share to the family members, is that this isn't, if you're noticing your service member is distant, it's probably not on purpose. It's probably because of necessity, because of the demands of the job, trying to balance everything. And maybe if they're not performing they're in their role as a family, family member, spouse, parent, it might be helpful to have a conversation about it. Not with an accusing kind of way, but to have a conversation. Hey, I'm noticing that there's a lot demanded from you. Where are we at? Having that ongoing open dialogue is, I think, really vital. Not to just assume everything's good, or assume, well, she just always wants to be at the base, or you know, whatever. Like, having open conversations is really important in relationships.
Right. Military family members make their own sacrifices.
For sure.
It's just different. It's different types of sacrifices, being left behind with all of the family responsibilities and
bills.
Responsibilities and bills.
Yeah.
And then children. Are there resources available for military spouses and children
yes.
that are left behind?
There is a Sesame Street program for kids that talks specifically about deployed family members. That's always a kind of a good thing to refer to, just because they're characters that kids are familiar with. But as DPH, it would be part of my responsibility to be able to connect family members to any kind of care that they need, or service support that they need. A lot of times in conjunction with family readiness. What I would do with family members would be for adult family members. I can't see children, but I can recommend to, like, parents maybe places to go. Going through an assessment with the family members, like with, you know, with wife or with husband who's left behind. And identifying, okay, well, here's some of the things that sounds like are really important to you. Let's get you connected to people or to a place that would be able to address that. If you need to go to counseling, maybe if you need, like, a support group, maybe a grief and loss group, getting connected with veterans benefits. At whatever level you want services and support, there's a lot. Military One Source has a specific section for National Guard and reservists.
Okay.
So they're a really good kind of an open 311 directory for that stuff. The local veterans groups, veterans advocacy groups are really, really active, particularly in the Fort Wayne area, but also in the surrounding areas. I think Blue Star Moms is they're a really good organization. Just met them at the Yellow Ribbon event a couple months ago.
Okay.
Providing people, mothers who have deployed service members support back home. Basically, don't suffer in silence. If you're a family member who's struggling with deployment, irritate us. Call family readiness, call me. If you need something, we'll get you connected.
Does that go for even if it's not a deployed situation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. If family members are just generally struggling, I can do some assessment and get him kind of referred, give him recommendation. Here's maybe what might be useful. Have you go see. That's okay. Definitely within my role.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited that we have this opportunity to sit down and talk today, because I know in the past when I was looking for someone to talk to, sometimes all you have is like a web page with a photo, and you're kind of like trying to read between the lines, like, is this someone that I would feel comfortable talking to? And, you know, sometimes you just like, oh, I'll just call them, take the leap, and we'll see how it goes. And if I don't like talking to them, I guess I'll have to find someone else, you know. But I think this is a great opportunity for people to kind of get to know you a little bit ahead of time and just understand how you think. And, yeah, it's kind of cool.
If you have a question about me, just please come up and talk to me. I'm not always real good about being super outgoing, a quiet guy. But I am excited to be here. I am glad to be a part. I'm very thankful to be accepted so far out here at the 122nd. You don't have to even talk to me about anything you don't want to. If you just want to come chat, you can do that. That's no problem. I'm here to be as helpful as I can.
Thank you, Ben. I can say for sure we're very happy to accept you here and very happy that you're here, a part of the 122nd Fighter Wing. So thank you for talking with us today. I'm really excited to share our conversation with the audience, because this is really, really important for the airmen here and their families and our community. So thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
This is the official podcast of the 122nd Fighter Wing. Views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of the 122nd Fighter Wing, Air National Guard, or United States government. No endorsement of any person or business is ever intended.